You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny, springy, like Davis day. Don, 72 degrees this week, and then within the same week, 59 for a high. What's going on?
Actually, the night temperatures are somewhat more relevant, but let me tell you, the conversations we've been having at our garden center focus heavily on summer vegetables at the moment. We got to 70.
Is it time to plant tomatoes?
Yeah, I don't know how many conversations I had about tomatoes and peppers and squash and melons and things like that. And I am just really delighted to see everybody so enthusiastic about planting a summer garden. My kid is doing that, took Weed Eater out, chopped down all the grasses, sent me a note, said, bring home corn seed, Dad. I said, sweetie, it's February. So good to see the enthusiasm. Go ahead and cut those weeds down. We spread our tarp out over a big area. We're getting ready. It is a little early to put some of those summer vegetables in the ground. Today's date, as we are recording this, is February 26th, 2025, for broadcast on February 27. Temperature right now, according to the National Weather Service, is 59 degrees, at least to the station nearest my house, going up to a high today of 69 degrees, and tonight's low temperature will be 44 and mostly clear. A little change in the weather for the weekend. We just had a very sunny, lovely week here in Northern California, and Thursday, the day of the broadcast, will be mostly sunny and 71 degrees. Thursday night, partly cloudy, 46 degrees. Friday, 69 degrees and mostly sunny. Friday night, 46 and partly cloudy. Cooling off as we go into the weekend. Saturday will be partly sunny and 63 degrees with a chance of showers Saturday night and only a low of 48, but not a big storm. This is just a chance of showers. I consider this fungus weather. Sunday will be a high of 60 with showers likely, even more fungus weather. And that'll mostly be before 4 p.m. And then Sunday night, a chance of showers and only getting down to 43. As Monday, chance of showers, 59. Monday night, 42. Tuesday, chance of showers. None of these are big events, maybe a tenth of an inch kind of thing. This storm is mostly going north of us, partly sunny with a high near 58. Let's see what the extended forecast is telling us as I go to the National Weather Service here. Overall trends are consistent. They say they're getting better ensemble guidance. That's their way of saying the models are converging on the reasonably confident outcome. Precipitation impacts through the end of the weekend into early next week. Some minor differences between the models, but not a lot of rain. However, snow levels will drop. There should be some snowfall up in the mountains. Not a lot, but some, about 8 inches through Monday at locations in the Sierra and the Southern Cascades. Most of this storm is going to far north Sacramento Valley. We'll see the fringes of it and a little bit of scattery showers. Question that keeps coming up is, does this affect spraying fruit trees, for example, for preventing peach leaf curl? Well, the answer to that is, here, you may be late because a lot of the buds have already broken. It won't hurt if you spray and then it rains a little bit that night or the next day, but it reduces the efficacy somewhat. We're rapidly getting past the stage here in the Sacramento Valley where dormant spraying is going to do any good for peach leaf curl, if that's what you're spraying for, because you need to spray before the buds break. And most of my trees have either started to break or are even further along and coming into bloom. So you don't want to get that done if you're going to do that, and you need to do it as you want 24 hours without rain, but you know, you can't always arrange that. It's not always that convenient. As I drove in the other day, three different Almond orchards were being sprayed by helicopters, which is what they use nowadays for crop dusting. They were spraying them in full bloom. And someone asked me about that. And they said, really, they spray them when they're in bloom? Isn't that bad for the bees? I was driving in very early, so it's before bee activity. And farmers do that. They spray either early in the evening, sometimes in the middle of the night. I've heard that. And very commonly right at sunrise, because the bees are not, in fact, active. And they are using fungicides that are at least tested to some degree for not being a problem for the bees. But they generally do it at the much cooler time of day, because European honeybees don't like to fly out there when it's dark or cold. They stay in their hives when it's dark and cold. They stay in their hives when it's cloudy. So they like to do it early, early, early in the day. And then it's dried off on the trees before the bees come out, I don't know, 10 a.m.-ish. Should note our native bees come out early, but the European honeybees don't even get up until brunch. So yes, they're out spraying for the now they're spraying those trees in bloom. I mentioned leaf curl and other disease problems and how you shouldn't spray, you know, there's no point in doing it once the buds break. Obviously with almonds, they're not spraying for peach leaf curl, first of all. Second, they're spraying for brown rot, which is a fungus that attacks through the blossom on almonds and apricots in particular. Those are the big concern. They're very early blooming trees. Those you do spray when they're in bloom. So if you're concerned about brown rot, you're going to be a farmer. You're going to be out there spraying while the trees are blooming. Home gardeners, in my opinion, do not need to spray for brown rot. You should prune your trees to minimize brown rot. And the key there is to get a more open growth habit so there's better air circulation. That was a long digression from the weather. So let's move on to the usual stuff we do here before we get into the meat of the show. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from listeners like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. So you got an announcement there about poisonous frogs.
Bohart Open House features poison dart frogs. Now, that's the banner headline over there on the Davis Enterprise. And they have a whole article about what's happening. Sunday, March 2nd, the Bohart Museum of Entomology is going to have a theme of venomous versus poisonous. And it's an event going on from 1 to 4 p.m. in room 1124 of Surge. And yeah, go to their website and find the place to go.
Yeah.
So yeah, here's the bit that got me.
Yeah.
Neurobiologist and behaviorist Eva Fisher, who joined the UC Davis faculty in 2024, will be at the Bohart Museum with her poison dart frogs live.
This is the coolest thing I've heard in months. This is really great.
She says it will be safe because they're not toxic. In the lab, because they get their toxins from their diet. They derive their poisons from a diet of insects, which includes ants, mites, and termites. Anyway, it's a whole big thing. It sounds fantastic. Go read the article. Go to Bohart Museum. Oh, no, excuse me.
It's Bohart.
Bohart, B-O-H-A-R-T, at ucdavis.edu.
Bohart.ucdavis.edu. And there it is, venomous versus poisonous. And she's going to bring poisonous dart frogs. I think that is absolutely cool. We do not, just for the record, have poisonous frogs in this area. So don't be concerned about going out in your garden and encountering these, but you can learn all about them at this event. So.
Okay. And then we're just an early alert. Mark your calendars if you want to go over to Patricia Carpenter's place, because they're having another one of those garden rambles, and you can drop in anytime between 10 a.m. and 3 p.m. rain or shine. When you get there, you'll get a little map to use, and it's March 16th on a Sunday. So put that on your schedule. And the other one to put on your schedule, or actually there's something more with this one.
Okay.
This is the Master Gardeners Thursday workshops, and that's on Zoom, so you don't have to go in person. And they have, it's every other week, basically. March 13th, Peggy Smith will be talking about strategies for success in that garden.
Peggy was Volunteer of the Year in Davis this year.
Oh, cool.
Very active volunteer at the Central Park Gardens and others of the wonderful community gardens and such that we have around the area. So great, it should be a great presentation.
And February 27th, which is today, or the day you're hearing this, or maybe it was yesterday. Anyway, it's Seed Startings, and you probably won't be able to get to that one. But if you can, it's there. Now, if you want to get any information about any of these programs, what you have to do is you have to write with an email to Joan, J-O-A-N, .TUSS@YOLOCounty.gov. And then you'll get on the list, and then they'll send you announcements, and there you go. If you want to know more about the Master Gardeners, the Master Gardener program of Yolo County is through the University of California. Mm-hmm. And the way to get to it, the URL, I'll read this slowly. Yep. YOLOMG.UCARN.EDU.
UCANR, isn't it?
Oh, no. Let me do that over again. Okay. YOLOMG.UCANR.EDU.
Wherever you are in California, replace that YOLO with your county, and you'll get to your own Master Gardener link.
Oh, cool.
Yep. YOLO MG is YOLO Master Gardener. So if you're in Sacramento, just replace YOLO with Sacramento. We've got lots of cool programming here at KDRT, and I want to mention a brand new show that aired for the first time on February 19th, That California Sound, by producer John Emery, features local, regional, and small touring bands making their way through California while highlighting the history and culture of California musicians, venues, teachers, recording studios, promoters, festivals, and general resources that enrich our community. That is live Wednesdays from 3 to 4 p.m. A podcast is available, That California Sound, here at KDRT. For the whole schedule of all the programming, just hit kdrt.org and look for the schedule guide.
So this question came to Don as a walk-in. And the question was, do you sell ladybugs? I have aphids all over my fava beans and I want ladybugs.
So we have gradually stopped selling ladybugs at our garden center, primarily because of the very high mortality rate. So when we would try to stock them and display them, and we had very good vendors that would bring them to us, even a local one, we'd put them out and we would watch as over a 2 to 3 week period, you'd get up to as many as a quarter to half of them in each package dying. I don't think that's a really good thing to be doing, particularly. You'll read a lot of controversy out there as to whether it's effective or good to release ladybugs. So for those of you in other parts of the country, you should understand one thing. We're in the region that ladybugs are collected from to sell to you. Okay. If you go up into the coastal mountain range, just 40 miles west of here, you can come across the convergent ladybird beetle. Converging. I've done it. I'm hiking around up in the Coast Range many years ago, and you suddenly realize that crunching sound is you stepping on a lot of ladybugs, because there are tens of thousands of them swarming around a little creek or a little shaded area. They are called convergent because indeed they do converge, and they're also migratory. They migrate from the Coast Range and the foothills down into the valley where we are and back up. But here's the other thing. There is a large resident population of them here year round. On my own farm, I can find ladybird beetles, or ladybugs as we commonly call them, any time of year, not just at the time when they're migrating, but also just this month, going out there on a sunny day in February, looking at a stump out there, there's going to be ladybugs crawling up and getting into the sun on a sunny day in the wintertime. So we have a resident population here. So if you're concerned about whether it's appropriate to release them, well, in this area, you're releasing something that someone just collected from about 50 miles away. That part I'm not concerned about, the ecological significance of releasing something that's basically native in our area. Those of you in other regions, that may or may not be the case. I've also seen convergent ladybugs in the Black Hills of South Dakota. This is not the only place where you get millions of them converging during their mating rituals, or whatever you want to call them. There are licensed dealers who can go up to where they're converging, can collect them, can put them in cold storage, not freezing, it's really important, but refrigerator temperatures. And they go into this torpor in which they barely feed, and they're just looking for all the world like they're dead. And if you store them under refrigerated conditions, you can keep them that way for a surprisingly long time. Retailers don't do that for the most part. We get them, and we're supposed to just put them out on the shelf, and you're going to come in and buy them. Some of these vendors put a little bit of a food source in. One of them, it was literally just a raisin. Okay, so something that in there that they can feed off the sugar on the outside of the fruit and keep themselves alive. But they need moisture. And when they come to room temperature, they get alive and they try to scramble around and they starve and they simply die. So I just don't think it's a particularly good plan to try and sell ladybird beetles or ladybugs at the retail level. If you go to a place and they bring them out of a cooler, they're at least doing their best to keep them alive longer. But the other thing you'll hear is that it doesn't work. It does work. It can work. It can work very well. We have used at our nursery ladybugs as part of our aphid management strategy for years. We released them periodically until we got our own established population in our nursery of ladybugs that are present year round. That's the important take-home lesson here. If you have a yard that will attract and keep ladybugs, you probably already have them. If that yard will attract and keep ladybugs, releasing them can be effective if you do it right. If you wait until it's nearly dark, if you put them in a shaded part of the yard where there's moisture, and I like it just at sunset, this is how we do it at the nursery, we'll release them right at the end of the day. We would take the package and we would put it way back under a shelf somewhere, and they'll start crawling out, and then they stop because it's dark and cooler, and then in the morning they slowly crawl out and we come in and find them on the plants feeding on the aphids. So if you do it at the right time of day, under conditions of increasing darkness and they have moisture nearby, they will stick around long enough at least to eat all the aphids. When they've done that, they've run out of food, so they're not going to stick around. So at that point, especially if it's sunny, they'll fly away. I will say, if you go buy ladybugs and just set them out next to your rose bush in the middle of the day and it's sunny, you will watch them climb up and fly away even before they eat any of the aphids. So it is very likely that you won't see really good results if you release them on a sunny day on a single rose bush that happens to have some aphids. They'll eat some of them and they'll just fly away. This is why a lot of people don't think ladybugs particularly work. They do release them when the ladybug will follow its primal instinct to fly back to where they were converging and will just fly up into the sky. Or as one customer put it, it was like watching dollar bills fly away. They do eat a lot of aphids before they go. But that gets us to the next thing. Why do you care about aphids on your fava beans?
Fava beans?
Yeah, fava beans are being grown as a cover crop. Some people do eat the fava beans themselves. It's like a giant lima bean. They are edible. They're very good for you. But most of the people I sell fava bean seeds to are growing them as a cover crop. Having aphids on that plant, even if you're growing them for the beans, even if the bean itself is coated with aphids, so it may gross you out, but it doesn't reduce the yield. It doesn't do any harm to the fava bean itself. So if you have aphids in a place where they don't matter, that will be a food source for beneficial insects, including ladybugs, but also including leatherwing beetles and lacewings and the other things that feed on aphids. They will then come in and feed on them, get healthy and strong, reproduce and make more babies. So your fava beans now become a source for beneficial insects for elsewhere in your garden. So if you can tolerate some aphids where they don't matter, you'll get more and more beneficials building up in population and numbers. How do you keep them there? They need some moisture nearby. They like grasses because grasses have moisture even when there's not rainfall because of guttation. We can come back to that word in a moment. They like bushes that are dense and crowded. They like to have a flower source with nectar in the flower nearby. They do feed on that. And they, of course, ladybugs like to feed on bugs and other insects. And so they want to have some kind of a steady, reliable year-round food source, which means you need to tolerate some aphids in order to have a good standing population of ladybugs. And they don't feed on just aphids. They feed on thrips and mites and other things. So if you can tolerate the aphids on your fava beans, and they're not going to, that one is unique. It's specific to beans. It's not going to spread to your tomatoes or whatever later. Then just let that happen, because the other thing that'll happen if you watch closely, as I like to do, look at the population of the black aphids that are on your fava beans and notice that maybe one or two here and there are, instead of black, they're tan and they're bloated and they're listless. They've been parasitized by a parasitic wasp. And what's going to come out of that then parasitized aphid is more parasitic wasps and more and more and more, until eventually you'll have almost no aphids and a lot of beneficials spreading around your yard. The bottom line here, you don't need to release ladybugs. You probably already have them. You should work to keep ladybugs in your yard rather than adding more of them, because working to keep them is going to be more effective in the long run. And tolerating some aphid population or pest population, particularly on plants that don't really matter, is a great way to increase the presence of beneficials that will then go to the plants you care about. Long answer, short question, as usual.
Let's talk about some special words today. You used the word guttation. Did you explain that?
Guttation, no, and it's an important thing to be aware of because it can actually be an important water source for certain insects. Grasses in particular, but many plants, your rose bushes will also do this, as will some of your house plants. They'll have internal water pressure, fluid, really, it's water with stuff in it, that exceeds what the plant can transpire through its stomata. So this will just express itself through certain pores or openings in the plant. And you may be looking at your split leaf philodendron early one morning and see a droplet of water down at the end of the leaf. Have you ever seen that? That's guttation from within the plant. If you go out very early in the day and look at grasses, even during a drought, grasses will have been taking up water. And then as sunrise comes along, it will express itself as little beads of water on the edge of the leaf, the grass blade. And on rose bushes, you'll see it right on the edge of the rose leaf. That's guttation. It's coming from inside the plant, but it's a source of moisture. During a dry period when there's no rainfall and the soil is beginning to dry out, grass plants are tapping into moisture that's deeper down. And they can be actually a very important source of water for tiny insects that need moisture. So just having some ornamental grasses near your rose bush is a simple way to implement this aphid management strategy in your yard. Having some nice grasses that have broad leaves and that have those little droplets of water that are a few feet away from your rose bush, you're providing some habitat for beneficial insects and some moisture that way. Guttation on the edge and tip of leaves is actually an important water source for many insects.
So here's a question for you, Don. I have an abutilon that was in a disintegrating three-quarters barrel. That's one of the tall ones. And we cut the plant down to 2 feet. We transplanted it to a new pot about the same size and placed it back in its original position. After a slow start, the plant grew very well last summer. It doubled in height. But now, this winter, the leaves look wilted, and they have for a couple of weeks. Watering extra doesn't make a difference. The soil's already damp. The little plants in the pot are looking good. I have a little campanula and maple sprouts in there. Any idea what's going on that? Might it be winter blues or cold damage, or the new leaves are tiring out the old leaves, or maybe it's limp leaf syndrome.
Limp leaf syndrome. Do you suffer from LLS? Ask your doctor what might be suitable for this condition.
Ask your gardener.
Ask your garden doctor. That is a temperature-related phenomenon. We had a very, very cold spell in late January, and about a week later in early February, we got down into the mid-20s, depending on where you were, 28, 24 in Dixon, which did a lot of damage. And what abutilon, or flowering maple, this is one of Lois's favorite plants, as you know if you're a longtime listener of the Davis Garden Show, what it does, it's a subtropical plant. So it doesn't get a trigger like a deciduous plant does, that days are getting shorter, form an abscission layer, drop the leaves. It just keeps trying to flower, keeps trying to grow no matter what. I have pictures of abutilon, a flowering maple, in bloom every month of the year. And mine looked great in December and really good in January. And then we got very cold. And the leaves fold down in that situation. That's really what you're seeing, is that the petiole loses turgor or something, and the leaves also cup, which is a very common stress reaction in plants. They either fold or cup, inward or outward. And in the case of abutilon, they keep trying to grow and keep initiating flower buds and keep trying to bloom no matter what. So one common question I get about abutilon, when do I prune it? It never stops blooming. I say, you prune it whenever you want. You're correct. It never stops blooming. I don't prune personally, usually in the middle of freezing weather. But other than that, I don't care that much about it. Since it's technically considered subtropical, my rule with subtropicals, if you want to have a rule, is you don't prune them when there's a risk of cold injury. So you basically don't prune during frost season, which means you generally don't prune abutilon between about Thanksgiving and, say, the 1st of March. I've done it. I haven't had any problem, but I want to give you guys some guidelines. So the same thing goes for lantana and brugmansia and fuchsias and things that might get some cold injury. I would just wait. You'll watch as the weather warms up. That loss of turgor or the folding will undo itself, the plant will be back to normal and you don't have to worry about it. But if your concern is whether you should prune it or whether it needs anything, the answer is no, it doesn't need anything. And I wouldn't bother pruning it until things are warmer. So what you're seeing is almost entirely a temperature reaction. We just didn't have that much cold weather this winter. We had the chilling we needed for fruit trees. We had a fair bit of frost in January. In fact, almost every morning in January, we had visible frost on our farm, simply because of a lack of cloud cover, but that was 32, 33 degrees. That's not going to really cause any adverse impact on a subtropical. 28, 29 degrees did, and I can tell you that 24 degrees definitely did. So we actually had more cold injury this winter than normal, not because of a lot of cold, but because of a couple nights of lower than usual temperature, and that's what you're seeing.
So Don, it's the end of February, and I didn't prune my roses. Oh my goodness, I didn't prune my roses. Don, what do I do?
Well, that's kind of the way the question was put to me. Now, the rose you have, Lois, is a Lady Banks rose. And so pruning that would be done after it blooms because, no, you're not going to prune it?
I have another rose that I bought. It's that Betty Boop.
Oh, okay. Well, that one you could prune now. I get this question every year. What do I do? I haven't pruned my roses. Is it too late? No, you can prune your roses pretty much any time. This is an important point. Generally, we prune roses in January. Generally, you'll find all these checklists of rules for how to do them. But remember, we have a couple things that we'd really like to get across about roses. And one in particular is that they're easier than people make you want to think. How's that? I'm not sure how else to say this. My goal on the Davis Garden Show for a long time has been to encourage a new way of thinking about roses, get you into thinking them as landscape plants, not something that has to be in its own little silo in the garden. Or as I put it in one article I wrote long ago, bring them out of the garden beds and back into the landscape. Because when we first opened our nursery, everybody grew roses in this little zone of your backyard only. And they got all this special stuff. We had an entire display of just fertilizers and sprays and things just for roses. And that's how people grew roses. So let's say you're Lois and you think, I might like to get some roses, and you go to a garden center. You'll be overwhelmed. You'll be overwhelmed with choices. You'll be overwhelmed with products. And a lot of people who got casually interested in roses started to think, this is complicated. You have to spray these all the time. They need special fertilizer. I only prune them in January. There's all these rules for how to prune them. So let's repeat a really, 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 really important Davis Garden Show aphorism. A rose is just a deciduous woody plant that flowers on new growth. Not all of them, but most of them. Most of them are shrubs. In our climate, roses are very vigorous. Pest control is not necessary in most cases, but that roses are very vigorous, they love California's climate, means that one of our main purposes in pruning roses is simply size control. We don't want to get them to get too big. You may not have room for a rose to get as big as it wants to get. Maybe you've planted a rose that you want to get big. If you've planted a Lady Banks rose, for example, it's going to get really big. So you better plan on that when you choose your location. But they're just vigorous plants that mostly flower on new growth. Some flower on new wood, Lady Banks being an example. Hybrid teas, floribundas, most of the roses you're thinking of are just blooming on new growth. It is not necessary to prune them severely. It's traditionally done. And the reason for doing that is to get longer stems and bigger flowers. So the reason for pruning severely is to get roses that are better for competition, exhibition, or cutting. If those aren't your goals, you don't have to prune severely. Okay, so that's another important point. Much of the rose care advice that is given is focused just on hybrid tea roses, but it's presented as if it applies to all of them. Those are the most popular category. Most of it, I'm going to go ahead and say almost all of it, is unnecessarily complicated. And to me, the frustration as a retailer is that drives away people who might otherwise be interested in roses. They think, oh, I have to be an expert on that. No, you don't. No, you don't. You can grow roses very easily and you don't have to prune them in a particular way. There's a whole lot of different kinds of roses. That does get a little complicated, but there's a rose for every situation. There are roses that'll grow in the shade. There are roses that are just big background landscape shrubs that give one big bloom and that's it. Like Lady Banks is an example, and a lot of 19th century roses give one big bloom and that's it. So you might prune them hard just for the size control, but all that whole long checklist of things about choosing the canes and thinning them out and cutting to an outside bud, that's fine if your goal is roses for vases. But if your goal is roses for your yard, you don't have to do that. I come back to this amusing study test thing, if you want to call it that. It wasn't a published study, but a test that was done in the UK 20, 25 years ago, where they took some roses and they pruned them in the checklist manner. They took some roses and they just cut them in half. And they took some roses and pruned them with hedge shears. And I can hear rose experts just screaming with indignation about that. You know which ones gave them the most bloom? The ones that had been cut in half and the ones that had been pruned with hedge shears. The ones that had been pruned in the traditional manner gave fewer blooms, but they were bigger and more perfect. So that right there, that really simple study shows you that the pointers you've always been given are aimed at rose exhibitions. If you just like to walk out in your garden, enjoy a rose bush and smell the flowers out there, and maybe cut a few and bring them into the house, you can prune them much more lightly. You can make them much more attractive landscape plants, and you can prune them anytime. You can do light pruning to shape them. You can cut that blossom to bring it in, cut a little harder to make the plant a little bit shorter, and so on. One other purpose of pruning is to make better airflow. And in places where disease problems are your major issue with roses, which is anywhere that it rains in the summer, you will want to do that. You will want to prune perhaps harder, prune for a more open growth habit, because we know that airflow reduces disease problems. But what really reduces disease problems is wider spacing of the plants. So when I did my new rose garden on my farm a few years back, all my roses are at least 6 feet apart. And if it's a bigger plant, I gave it 8 feet of space so that I don't have to prune it hard to keep them from crowding each other. So I don't have to worry too much if a little downy mildew shows up on the one on the end and we have another rainstorm. Yeah, that one will get some more downy mildew, but it won't run riot through the entire bed because I have them on 2.5 foot centers. 6 feet apart, they'll get good airflow. Yeah, prune them for a little more open habit. And those of you in rainier climates understand you probably have to do some preventive spraying. But in California, most of California, you don't have to spray fungicides. If you choose your varieties carefully, you don't have to spray for any disease problems. And it doesn't take that much to minimize them, even on varieties that are susceptible, by giving them more space and pruning a little bit for airflow. So the main reasons for pruning are disease prevention and size control. And size control is our big deal here. And also many of those pointers are just to get more perfect flowers. If you're entering a rose exhibition, yeah, you do all that stuff. I have roses that I've left unpruned for 5 years just to see how they grow. And the main issue with them is they get bigger than I expected. And that's true in general for roses in California. So be aware of that. But you don't have to follow this long checklist of things. And I want people to not feel guilty about not having pruned their roses in January. If you didn't get it done, go out, clip them a little bit, shape them a little bit, clean them up, take off the hips, cut out any dead wood. You're done. And you don't really have to worry that much about it. You want something really simple and you just want size control and you feel like you need to prune them, cut them in half. There were a number of years, 20, 25 years ago, when I didn't have time to prune all of my 100 plus roses. And so there were young people who lived with me who wanted to earn some money, believe it or not. And so I handed them loppers and I said, cut all the roses in half. And they said, we don't know how to prune roses. I said, I didn't say that. I said, cut all the roses in half and pull the stuff out of the way. And I'll come in later and thin them out and do all that other stuff, the technical stuff. Well, you know, some years I never got around to the coming in later. They did great. The roses were fine. They gave lots of bloom and the stems were fine and the size of the blossom was fine. I simply was reducing the size. So I just want people to feel less guilty about not having pruned. Yes, you can prune at other times of year. And don't worry so much about those long checklists that you've been reading about how exactly you have to prune roses. Roses should be something we enjoy and have in the landscape. Yes, if you want a whole bed of roses, cool. I remember in the 80s and 90s in the nursery business, January was a very busy month, selling people 5, 10, 15 rose bushes at a time, helping them design layout and placement and all this kind of thing. But now let's say you go over to the Arboretum, and you happen to like the Ruth Storer garden, you're walking through there. Notice there's a handful of roses in there. Not a lot of them, but here and there, there's a rose here. And 15, 20 feet away, there's another rose. And there's aloes and there's ground covers and there's flowering perennials. They're using roses as landscape plants. And if we could get more people to do that, maybe less people would feel like roses are some complicated, rule-laden garden plant that they have to follow all these strictures or else they won't work properly. We're in a great place to grow roses. California is an excellent climate for them. And our main purpose here in pruning is size control, having them fit in your landscape and enjoying the appearance of the plant rather than necessarily growing them just for the perfection of a particular bloom.
Okay. Another question comes up, and this is one that when Don sent it to me, I sort of scratched my head, but it refers to the extreme heat we had in September of 2022. Yeah. But it says multiple conversations have come in over the last couple of months about trees that had significant cambium injuries on their trunks during the extreme heat of September 2022.
Yeah, we had a heat wave, which was a real eye-opener that year. We got to 116 degrees 2 days in a row. That matched or exceeded the highest temperature ever recorded in our area, not in July, in September. I mean, when I say exceeded ever recorded, I mean ever. And it was 2 days in a row. And then the next 2 days were 110. And the next 3 days were 106. So above 105 for 7 days in a row in the Davis area. And it did significant injury to the cambium, that is to say the water and food conducting tissue of trees. And you can tell that that's what it is because it burned them on the west side. So that's the hottest sun of the day. When it was 116 degrees, it was at 5 p.m. And that was directly on the trunk of many trees that we looked at and immediately caused visible sunburn, we'll call it. And it immediately ruptured the bark and the cambium was completely destroyed. About a third of the tree's water and food conducting tissue in many cases was totally destroyed. And these are species like flowering cherries, peaches, fruit trees, where they will heal, but they're still healing a couple of years later. And so that became open, that injury became open to borers to get in some cases and disease to get in some cases. And the trees, of course, were stunted by the fact that they couldn't take up water as well. So in some cases, the damage was so severe that the trees simply had to be replaced. In other cases, like fruit trees, well, they'll still keep producing. They may not grow as well, but look for, and people bring me pictures, look for the reaction wood that formed within a few months and the fact that that wood is growing back over that. If that's occurring and there's no sign of tunneling or holes or frass being pushed out or stuff sapping and running out, then the tree is healing itself. It still has a long way to go, but it's healing itself. And it may go back to full fruit production and may grow fine. Our biggest concern is with ornamental or shade trees, where it might become an important issue down the road with injury leading to heart rot and the tree becoming unsafe. But in the case of a fruit tree, I'm not as concerned about it. The question came up is how I could identify it and guess that that's what it was from. Well, just the fact that it's on the southwest or especially the west side of the tree, the progress of how the bark is healing, and the absence of any specific kind of insect or disease that might have been the cause in the first place. We don't see bacterial canker having caused this. We see just burnt wood. I mean, literally burnt trunk. So we're going by a little bit of deductive reasoning here that it was caused by direct heat on the trunk. That did a lot of damage. I mean, I looked at one tree in particular when I was working out on a retirement community. It was an alder where it dropped 25% of the leaves the next day and another 25% the day after. And the tree basically defoliated because of the extreme heat, injuring the trunk and direct injury on the leaves. That tree is recovering 2 years later, but that's what it's taken. And in that case, it's a big tree, important shade tree. I'm concerned about long-term stability and safety of that particular tree. So that's where you get into an arborist looking at it and evaluating whether a heart rot or something might be the next step in this process. But we saw a lot of injury from that extreme heat event. We were just underway on this larger tree list committee that was getting going to discuss trees for the area for the future, climate ready trees to be planting in the cities and parks. We pulled some things off that list because of the injury to them, including sadly incense cedar. Our native California native incense cedar were just torched by that extreme heat. Well, are we going to have that kind of heat again? I think we can say yes. So we will not be recommending incense cedar for a city street tree or park planting because of the severe injury from that extreme heat event, which was unprecedented, but likely to occur again.
So we have lots of trees in Davis and everywhere. Why didn't they all die?
Oh, some trees are adapted to extreme heat. I mean, this is a big question. As we're going through this process of trying to come up with lists of trees for parks, green belts, parking lots, residential subdivisions, city street trees, and so forth. We're looking at trees that are from the American Southwest, trees from desert regions, trees from other places around the world that have hotter climates than this. The first thing we did was pull up some of what we're calling analog cities for what our climate's likely to be in 50 years. We're going to be more like Barstow in Davis 50 years from now because of the kind of high temperatures that we experience. So what are trees that do well there? Trees that evolved and adapted to extreme heat environments already will be good choices for us to plant now for a hotter climate in the future. Many of the trees that are here now may not be suitable then. We just have to guess in some cases. Deodar cedar is a good example. They're doing extremely well. One of the few conifers that does very, very well around the region. We have a lot of them here, and compared to, say, Coast Redwood, they've taken heat and drought way better than Coast Redwood has. Will they be doing equally well 50 to 100 years from now? We don't really know. So it's one that we're recommending, what we say, with reservations. We recommend it, but let's not do a whole street of it. Let's do, and we shouldn't do a whole street of anything, do one here and then some kind of oak over there and something else over there. And that's really emphasizes the importance of species diversity in those kinds of lists and in the plantings that are done. Working with City Arborist and others, they'll be handed a design plan for a new subdivision, and there'll be, you know, three species of trees in one whole area. That's it. You know, dozens and dozens of a repetition of the same species. And he's taken to saying, I don't want more than 10% of any one species on this list. And the designers are taken aback by that. Well, that's kind of standard arboriculture principle right now. No more than 10%, the 10, 20, 30 rule. No more than 10% of any one species or cultivar. And but I want a long row of these oaks. We don't know if that oak is going to survive 50 or 100 years from now. It's on the list of trees that are susceptible to the invasive shot hole borer. We think it probably won't even be here 30 years from now. If you only did 10% of them, okay, reasonable gamble. A whole street of them? We've been down that road many times in urban forestry. There was a street in Davis, went from Russell north, which was entirely lined with California white alder in the 1970s. In the 1980s, a borer specific to them came into California, came into the valley, killed them all. None of them are left. 100% mortality of that one California native species all down that road. Regrettably, the city replaced them with all the same of another species. So it would have been better to replace them with 5 different species, 10 different species. But it's a hard thing to break out of, is that we want that lovely tree-lined street with the elms or the whatever all identical. We got to get away from that because of this kind of thing. A heat episode that took us all by surprise, it did significant damage to certain species. And that's why you're going to start seeing lists that include species you haven't heard of. Things from the Southwest, things from Morocco, things from, you know, hot, dry climates that we need to test here and see how they do in a hotter climate.
When you're talking about that 5 or 6 days in 2022 mm-hmm. that were so hot, mm-hmm. I know which direction is west.
Yep.
Woodhead have done good for me to go and take a roll of white cloth and hang it on the west side of that trunk. Would that have helped?
Yeah. You know what else would have helped? Whitewash or clay, kaolin clay spray. When you're biking or driving around the countryside here right before a heat wave, you'll often see some of the walnut orchards have been sprayed with what looks like white paint. It's actually kaolin, K-A-O-L-I-N, clay, which has a lot of interesting uses. And they spray it on the trees on the west side. They're doing it to protect the walnuts. Because if the walnut in its hull is directly, this happens on mine, if it's directly exposed to extreme heat, the hull will burn. And frequently, if it's really hot, the heat will penetrate and damage and basically destroy the kernel itself. So they're also protecting the leaves and the trunk to some degree, but they're using a clay spray. Kaolin clay spray, say that 10 times fast, K-A-O-L-I-N, clay spray, to reflect the sun, to protect the tree. And the first question that comes up, well, isn't that coating the leaves and preventing photosynthesis? Yes,
it doesn't wash off.
Well, it doesn't even wash off, it flakes off. Yeah, and it doesn't really hurt the tree. But this is one of the reasons that we always tell you, when you plant a young fruit tree, and this has especially been the case on my farm with pecans and walnuts as well, either paint the trunk all the way up to the first branch with an interior white latex, that's to prevent sunburn, or just get a trunk guard. And that's what I use now. And I went, when I first planted pecans and walnuts, I had 20%, 30% failure rate on the young bare root. They're always a struggle from bare root. When I took to just wrapping the trunk and making sure to wrap the graft with these roll-on trunk guards that every nursery has and that orchards use, I got as little as 5% failure rate. So it really made a huge difference. And it is, all it's doing is reflecting the sun when it's hot. And so that's we've always been recommending that you paint your trunks with an interior white latex. You can thin it out with water if you want to. Yes, if you knew a super, super, super heat wave was coming on and you had limbed up a tree so that the trunk was exposed. These were the worst cases. Recently pruned up, trunk suddenly exposed, now getting 116 degree heat on it. If you'd whitewashed that, you probably would have saved that tree. I had the customer send me a picture just a few weeks after the heat wave. He had bay laurel, which is a popular tree in our area, not the native one, but the Mediterranean. Does quite well here. Takes the heat very well, very drought tolerant. But he had just pruned all the lower branches off of it to make it more like a tree. And it, half the cambium was destroyed. I suspect it'll heal, but I have some concerns about the stability and the safety of that tree in the long run. So one of the things I'd like to suggest, if you don't have to limb up trees, that is to say, remove the lower branches, if you possibly can leave them, they perform some really important functions on the tree. They're photosynthesizing and strengthening the trunk. The reaction wood around them is strengthening the trunk, and they're shading the trunk and protecting it from sunburn. So whenever possible on my farm, I leave the lower branches if I possibly can. And I really do recommend it if you possibly can in a residential setting as well. Leave those lower branches on there. And if you happen to take them off and you see a super heat wave in the weather forecast, consider whitewash or maybe a clay spray. Whitewash is going to be easier for most homeowners.
So going to a happy place, someone came in and said, "Hey, Don, I'm looking for jasmine."
Yeah, that's always a fun conversation because this gets to the common name issue. It turned out they meant star jasmine. Okay, that's easy. Ooh. Yeah, which is not a jasmine. So many things are called jasmine because jasmine is much loved. I mean, it's one of those plants like lily, rose, jasmine, pinks. There's like a half dozen flowers. Almost anybody knows what you're talking about. And they're notable for their fragrance. And so there's a lot of things that smell good or strongly that are called jasmine. In fact, if it's a vine and it's fragrant, its species name is very commonly Jasminoides, which just means like a jasmine. Oides just means like. So Jasminoides just means like a jasmine, which means that it grows like a jasmine. That is to say, it's a vine and it twines on things. Or it smells like a jasmine, which you could say star jasmine does, or both. And it turned out they were actually looking for star jasmine. But true jasmine is itself is a big group of plants. That's the genus Jasminum. The most classic one is the one you see in Hawaii, Pikake, which has that wonderful sweet fragrance. But there's jasmine that we can grow here outdoors without having to protect it. That one from Hawaii is too tender to grow outdoors here. I know people who have them. They're usually in a sheltered location. Here we can grow jasmine polyanthem. The pink bud, white flowered jasmine, blooms in the spring, powerfully, powerfully fragrant, divided leaf, very pretty plant, runs all over your yard. Be careful where you plant it because it can really run. It doesn't spread by root runners or anything, but it can run across the ground without your noticing it and get up into things. But that's one that we can actually grow here that is a true jasmine. Probably more common, of course, is the star jasmine, which is not a jasmine. It's the genus Tracheospermum. And not everyone likes the smell of star jasmine. A lot of people find true jasmine a little overwhelming, but out in your garden, even a true jasmine will typically be fine. And there are members of the genus, by the way, that are not fragrant too. And there's some that are very pretty. Right around this area, we sometimes see blooming now in February, a yellow-flowered jasmine, Jasminum mesnii, sometimes called the primrose jasmine because the flowers are yellow and primrose is traditionally yellow. It's not fragrant at all, but it's a very tough plant. It's very adaptable. It's one of those big sprawling shrubby plants. It doesn't twine on things, but you can put it on a chain link fence, tie it up. For years, it was a solid fence of it around Toomey Field. If Davis residents remember where that was primrose jasmine around that field. And it blooms in February, which is pretty cool, but it's not fragrant. So when someone asks for jasmine, we have to do a little filtering down to see what they actually mean. In this case, they're just using it as a common name.
So, Don, it's February. Is it time for Hardenbergia to be blooming?
Mm-hmm. They are beginning to bloom. Actually, they were budding up because of all the sunshine we had in January. Many of them have been blooming since January. However, Hardenbergias are just on the edge of frost hardy in the valley. And my guess is that a lot of you probably saw some frost injury on your Hardenbergias this year. They initiate their buds. This is a purple flowered plant. The most common one in the trade is called Happy Wanderer. It's a vivid royal purple. That's a color that sells itself. We can just stick it out there. Don't even put a sign on it. We know they'll sell. And it blooms midwinter. The only issue is if we get below about 30 degrees, all those flower buds that initiated in November can be damaged. And that happens about every 4 or 5 years here. It wouldn't surprise me if it happened this year. But I do need to say this about the lilac vine or Hardenbergia or Happy Wanderer. Our experience has been it lasts 5 to 7 years. And I've taken to saying that to people when they buy it, so they aren't disappointed 5 to 7 years down the road. It just grows rapidly and then dies. It appears to be Phytophthora, but it's so consistent. And I was swapping notes with a landscape designer in the Bay Area. He was saying the same thing, and other contractors. Yeah, it goes great, makes a nice quick screen, and then it dies. That can be very handy, actually, if you want that. If you've got a brand new neighborhood and you've got a fence and your neighbor has a two-story and you're planting shrubs that are going to take their time to get up there, Hardenbergia will run along the fence and you can put a fence extension up. It'll happily cover that by the second year. And it'll bloom in the winter if it doesn't get frosted. And it'll cover nice and give a nice dense cover. And then it'll probably die in about 5 years. So as long as you're okay with that, I don't have a problem selling it. But I don't want to just put them out and have people go, this is great, thanks, and then come back a few years later wanting to know why it died. So they're short-lived, but very useful up until that point.
I killed plants. But my daughter gave me this cactus, and it lived for a while, but now it's dying. I'd like to get something to replace it in this pot.
Yeah, this one, our first question when we have this kind of thing is, does the pot have a drainage hole? Fortunately, no. In this case, they brought the pot in, and the answer is no. So I was amazed the cactus had lived even for a while. Anything in a pot that doesn't have a drain hole, you have to be a pretty good gardener to know how to water correctly in a pot that doesn't drain.
I saw something on my phone about that one should use some beer, or another one about, so I added sugar to the water. Yeah. So I guess I should stop doing that and go back to regular water.
Yeah, there are moments in retail where you have to learn to control your facial expressions. Beer doesn't really hurt plants, but there's no reason to use it. Sugar, no plants need sugar. This comes up every so often for one reason. Plants make sugar. They don't need sugar applied. Anyway, we didn't make fun of her, but it was an entertaining thing to say. Yes, you should go back to the regular water. Okay.
Yeah, but we're still talking about replacing the cactus with something.
Yeah.
And it was a cactus, so I mostly just left it alone. But every now and then I'd give it, a little bit of water, maybe a tablespoon or so. So anyway, I want a cactus thing like you have outside there.
Yeah. So for a pot with no drain hole, looking for a cactus. And then our first question was, you're looking at the ones that are outside. Are you going to keep this outside?
Oh, no. I want it indoors.
Okay. So cactus in general are not real good indoor plants. The pot not having a drain hole is another issue right there, but yeah, that'll be a real problem. There are cactus that grow indoors, but they're not like you're thinking. There are tropical cactus, which are really cool. Actually, I'm kind of into them. The Rypsilis and Rypsilidopsis group. They are epiphytic cactus from Brazil, Central America, both, I think. And they are really cool indoor plants, but they're not a round barrel cactus like you're thinking of. So to say there are no cactus that grow indoors would not be completely correct. And there's one that's pretty well known for growing indoors. That's the Christmas cactus or Thanksgiving cactus. Those also can grow indoors as long as you give them the day length change they need in order to initiate bloom. But that wasn't what she was thinking of. She was thinking of like, you know, your golden barrel or something like that. Cactus need very bright light. They really need to be outdoors. I have seen pictures of cactus collections, and my favorite one I used to use in talks was in Norway. So obviously they're not going to be outdoors there, but they had them in their windowsill and they had a grow light over them. So they got natural light and some augmented light. They were doing reasonably well. I would suggest that maybe one, get a pot that has a drain hole. Two, water more thoroughly when you do, and then, you know, longer intervals between watering perhaps. And cactus aren't perhaps the best choice for someone who wants to grow something indoors. We steered her, just for the record, towards Sansevieria, snake plant. There's lots of cool Sansevierias. They can go weeks without water. They wouldn't absolutely need a drain hole. The issue of not having a drain hole is that if you put on what seems like the appropriate amount of water for the plant, it has no place to drain out the bottom of the hole. It'll stand in the bottom of this bowl and lead to root rot. So you would have to water very carefully. I kept a plant when I was in the dorms as a college student. I kept a plant in a pot that didn't have a drain hole, and I calibrated exactly how much water it took at that time. It was about a half a cup of water. If there was an excess, I would carefully tip it and pour it back out, and I could go a couple of weeks between waterings with that particular plant in that particular pot. That was a nephitis.
Yes.
Nephitis syngonium. It's got a couple other names. That is an extremely adaptable plant for indoors. It can actually stand in water. Every now and then, someone will come in with some device they've been given where it's going to be full of water. It might even have a goldfish or something down there. They're supposed to put a plant in the top. They're going, "What plant can grow in this?" And it's my ready answer every time. Nephitis or syngonium will grow in that situation. But we were trying to calibrate our plant selection to her level of horticulture. In our case, we felt Sansevieria was probably the best choice.
If someone has a pot that they really like, it's really pretty, it matches the decor, it's got to be this pot, and it doesn't have a hole. Well, one of the things that I do all the time is I get a pot with a hole that's smaller that will sit inside of the big pot. And then the big pot acts like just, a saucer.
Saucer. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
And
in
that way I can pick up the inner pot and look down there and make sure I don't have 2 inches of water sitting in it. But it's a way to accommodate people to have their pretty bowl.
Yes, in the industry, those are called jardiniere for some reason. That's just the term they've always used for a pot that doesn't have a hole. So you can plant things in them if you're really careful with your watering and all that kind of stuff. But better is to just use it as a cover for the ugly pot that the plant came in. You can just set it right in there and have it be a decorative covering for that. Alternative is to get a masonry bit and drill a hole in the pot. And sometimes they shatter when you do that, but usually they don't. So it is possible to drill a hole in a pot. Asking your nursery to do that makes us really, really, really nervous because sometimes they shatter when you do it. So if it was your grandfather's pot and you really want to take care of it, wouldn't be the best plan. But new gardeners, a pot without a drain hole is just a problem.
So Don, I know you got me an apium tree and it's there waiting to be planted. I'm assuming if I measure from the sidewalk to the current plum tree and double that should be about the right size from the trunk of the current plum tree to the trunk of the new tree. Does that sound about right?
Oh, okay. I think I see what you're saying. How close together can you plant your new apium and your plum?
No, how far apart should I
Okay.
plant my new apium and plum?
You'll read many different bits of advice on this. 10 to 12 feet apart would give you enough room forever to get in all around the tree and prune it and harvest the fruit. You can go closer than that if you wish to. I have lots of people who put plums in particular or pluots with plums 8 feet apart in their yards. And then they, of course, will grow to touch, but they prune them to keep them from crowding each other. If you really want to pack fruit trees into your backyard, you can put them 6 feet apart, but you're going to have to prune hard. With summer pruning, all of that's manageable. And plums and pluots and apricots and apriums are all particularly amenable to summer pruning. It actually works really well for all of those. In fact, with apricots and presumably apriums, it's best to prune them only in the late summer because of a particular disease problem that they get. So 10-foot spacing is, in my opinion, the most practical. 8 foot is not unreasonable. People who put them closer together are clearly going to prune more severely for size control, but it can be done.
Well, we always end with a garden quote. Some have likened gardening to poetry, but I think it's a much longer commitment. Maybe a novel, maybe a blog. I think I'll go write in the erasure of some weeds in my garden.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.